from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 50 years ago today, following near unanimous congressional support, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Wilderness Act into law. The landmark bill designated more than 9 million acres as wilderness areas, defined as lands, quote, untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain, end of quote. Today's wilderness system encompasses nearly 106 million acres throughout the country's national parks, forests, and wildlife refuges. And in this forum segment, we discuss the legacy of the Wilderness Act and the future of the American wilderness. Ambitious to put into a half-hour segment, but let me tell you who's joining us. Steve Dunsky's here in studio. He's a filmmaker with the U.S. Forest Service, organizer of Vallejo's Festival, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, Visions of the Wild, connecting nature, culture, and community. And I discovered that Vallejo is actually the most ethnically diverse city in the United States. It's 25% Caucasian, 25% African American, 25% Latino, and 25% Asian American. And last time I saw Steve Dunsky, it was over at the Conservation Biology Biennial Congress in Oakland. Thank you for being with us. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
And we're also joined this segment by Nancy Unger, who's here with us in studio also. She's professor of history at Santa Clara University. She's also an environmental historian and the author of a book called Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, American Women in Environmental History. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you. Well, let me talk to you as the historian here, because before the 1960s, one would think by reading what went on that there was a kind of license to exploit and dominate nature. I mean, this Wilderness Act really gave us a whole reality of what it means to be environmental minded, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really hard to imagine today, when we're so attuned to environmental issues, how unusual this was in earlier American history. I mean, early on, the wilderness was something to be feared, and then it was something to be tamed. But the idea that it should be preserved was really kind of unthinkable for many generations. The wilderness was something which people really tried to wrest their living out of this. And so the idea that you would protect it would have been shocking to generations of Americans.
Of course, we're still trying to define what we mean by wilderness. Untrammeled, that's a pretty strong word. I mean, you've got trails that are maintained, you've got firefighters, you've got people who are going out in nature in all these different ways, and yet there's been this kind of split, I suppose, between what we call wilderness and wildness.
Yeah, I would say that, and this is one of the things that I like about the Act, is that it recognizes there's going to have to be some wiggle room there, that you're going to have pathways for firefighters to get in. If you want people to enjoy this, they're going to have some way to get in. But once you start having people, they begin to change it. And this is the real question. What can you have wilderness and people in the same place?
Let me go back just to the history for a moment, because I want to get Steve Dunsky involved in this conversation and our listeners as well. But many really saw this as a waste of our resources. I mean, there was a good deal of opposition. The Wilderness Act, in other words, infringing on our right to do whatever we want with nature and make money off it and set for it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that I just came from camping in Yosemite. And I think when you go to Yosemite and you see, well, yes, this is our land and we see what impact that has. Yosemite is a beautiful place, but it's filled with roads and stores and, you know, we have mountains with handrails. The idea that we should have, I think, seeing something like that and appreciating it also helps us to appreciate the need for the Wilderness Act, to have an area that is truly designed not just for the pleasure of people, but to be in and of itself.
And again, Nancy Unger is professor of history at Santa Clara University and author of Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, American Women in Environmental History. Steve Dunsky is a filmmaker, works for the U.S. Forest Service, organizing a Vallejo Festival. We'll tell you something about that, but also it's called the Visions of the Wild, and it's a festival that runs from September 3rd to the 6th in Vallejo. There will be music, art shows, film screenings, panel discussions at the Empress Theater, and many other events throughout the downtown area. And listeners can find more information and the full schedule of events by going to www.visionsofthewild.org. Steve, let's go back historically with you, too, though. I mean, we go back to Aldo Leopold, 1924.
That's right. My wife and I are filmmakers with the Forest Service, and a couple of years ago we released a film called Green Fire, Aldo Leopold and a Land Ethic for Our Time.
A film that I've seen. It's quite good, in fact.
Well, thank you. And Leopold, in addition to being a great ecologist and somebody that really was a forerunner in the fields of restoration ecology and conservation biology and environmental ethics, was also the person that really proposed the first wilderness area. that became the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. That was in 1924. So that was 40 years before the Wilderness Act. Leopold was so far ahead of his peers and so far ahead of his time. And that wilderness area was protected by the Forest Service for all those years. But in reality, even though the Forest Service had set aside lands as primitive areas and so on during that intervening period, it didn't really have legislative protection. So it was the work of Howard Zonheiser and others in the 1950s to get this passed as national legislation that really provided that preservation.
So this is what we call the new conservationists who came into play here and were part of this move and what impelled this legislation. But also, I think, the Sierra Club played a role too, didn't it?
Yeah, the Sierra Club did. David Brower was a big advocate for wilderness, and he worked closely with Howard Zonheiser. A lot of people in the environmental community know Dave Brower, but to a great extent, Howard Zonheiser is largely unknown. And he was the person that actually, for 8 years, worked the Congress to get this bill passed. And sadly, he died just 4 months before it was passed.
So what does this mean that this area is protected? I mean, motorized vehicles can't go there, I guess, and chainsaws aren't supposed to go there. But on the other hand, the idea is maybe that mule packers would be provided for access?
Well, as you noted, it's really wilderness is a complicated idea, just like nature is a complicated idea. It's not something that we can just pass off lightly. And wilderness is actually something paradoxically that is managed. The Forest Service manages many, many acres of wilderness, and we do that in order to maintain it in some way that we feel is appropriate. We fight fire in wilderness, we manage invasive weeds, we manage recreation. And so there is this irony that in some ways, in order to have that wilderness experience, you do have to manage it.
But there's a kind of divide here that I want to take up with you, Professor Unger. Nancy Unger, you're talking at one point about, for example, how if a beaver cuts down a tree, it's very different than if a human cuts down a tree. I mean, we have sort of a different view, and it's bifurcated.
Right. Well, this has been one of the criticisms of the Wilderness Act. Bill Cronin wrote a very famous essay called The Trouble with Wilderness, Getting Back to the Wrong Kind of Nature. And he says the Wilderness Act is great, what it does and what it stands for. But he says this notion that wilderness is wonderful and should be preserved because it doesn't have people in it, he says, really sort of creates this artificial divide. As Steve just suggested, you know, are people not part of nature? And so this has been one of the real questions that it brings up, and it's brought up a lot of resentment.
Some might say yes, people should not be part of it. Robinson Jeffers comes immediately to my my mind. Yeah,
right.
Well, Steve, there's also a sense that this nature belongs. I mean, here you're doing this in Vallejo because of the fractionalization and the diversity of Vallejo and so forth in terms of the human beings and everything. But there's also that argument that maybe those who go into the backcountry, effectively high country news, unbearable whiteness of backpacking. I mean, this is a pretty privileged kind of Caucasian group that goes to the wilderness.
I think that's true. And also the conservation movement generally has been largely white and affluent. And so trying to, you know, in recent years there have been efforts to diversify the movement, and I think this is just some small part of that. I do want to say, picking up on what Nancy said, that Native Americans, for example, have a very different view of the land than the Eurocentric view of wilderness, this idea that you spoke of, Michael, that people are separated from the land. And so this Visions of the Wild Festival, the intent of it was to bring in all these different visions, all these different perspectives. And so we have a very strong Native American component of people coming. In fact, we're showing a film called Standing on Sacred Ground by Toby McLeod, a local filmmaker.
Toby McGuire is a famous actor. If you bring him in, you're
going to attract more people. Maybe we should get the word out on that. But anyway, we want to get all these different perspectives. So we are bringing together a very diverse group of people to present at the Visions of the Wild Festival.
Well, we're talking not only about the Wild Festival, which you can participate in, that runs from the 3rd of September to the 6th in Vallejo. And again, you can find out more information by going to visionsofthewild.org. But I'd like to hear from you, our listeners, as we, celebrate really the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. What does wilderness mean to you? How do you define wilderness? And, should we of sapient stock, that is of human being species, be part of that and seen as part of it. Can you separate humans from the wilderness, or should you and do you need to separate them from? Let me invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, or if you have comments or questions about the Wilderness Act, feel free to join the program. Again, you can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. Or post any question or comment you might have immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. 50 years ago today, following a near unanimous congressional support, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Wilderness Act into law, and it designated more than 9 million acres as wilderness areas, defined as lands, quote, untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. And there again is that important use of language for that time. Today's wilderness system encompasses nearly 106 million acres throughout the country's national parks, forests, and wildlife refuges. And we're discussing the legacy of the Act and the future of the American wilderness. And some of you may want to weigh in on that. I mean, how sanguine and how optimistic and hopeful are you about the future of the American wilderness? Or do you look at it with a sense of pessimism as we continue to trammel, as we continue to move forward with progress, what E. Cummings called that comfortable disease? Steve Dunsky's with us, filmmaker with the U.S. Forest Service and organizer of the Vallejo Festival celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, Visions of the Wild, Connecting Nature, Culture, and Community, and Nancy Unger, who's a professor of history at Santa Clara University, an environmental historian and author of Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, American Women in Environmental History. Can you say something about American women in environmental history? I know you wrote a whole book on it, but it's a subject that really probably is pretty ignored and that people are maybe dim on.
Well, I would just say that I was thinking about this in preparation for this talk. It's hard for some of my readers and from my students to really grasp, as I mentioned earlier, how much wilderness was seen as something that shouldn't be protected. It should be exploited. And particularly, this was something that men who had to provide for their families believed strongly. So they said, well, yeah, women tend to talk about environmental protection in the wilderness because they have that luxury. They don't have to get out there and rest a living from it. But it is, there are sort of some amazing quotes considering where we stand today. Here's a man talking about how conservation is unadulterated humbug and these dire prophecies about losing nature, baseless vaporings.
What year is this, Nancy? I'm just interested because we had Teddy Roosevelt, who was a leading conservationist, going way back.
Well, this is right about same time, and in saying, well, Teddy Roosevelt and these women, they're talking about some dangerous things. He says the pine woods of Michigan have vanished to make the homes of Kansas. And the coal and iron, which we have failed, thank heavens, to conserve, have carried meat and wheat to the hungry hives of men and gladdened life with the abundance which no previous age could have known. We've turned forests into villages, mines into ships and skyscrapers, scenery into work. And so I think it's really a tremendous tribute to Theodore Roosevelt that in this same time period, he was able to introduce a widespread acceptance of conservation thinking.
And did women play a role in this?
Oh, women played
an integral role in this.
They played a very, very large role in this, but it's a double-edged sword because when women were playing a large role in this, it was often dismissed as sentimentalist. You know how women are. They're sentimental about nature.
It's a wonderful play, which has now made much more impact than when it was first produced by the Provincetown Players up in New England, called Trifles, which you may be familiar with, by Ellen Glasgow, and it's all about men regarding what women do as trifling. You know, it's the kitchen. It's that, and that's 1960, and that's actually even before women got the vote, which is 1920. Let's get our callers on, and Bob, we begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to call and make a comment. I have a place in Mendocino County. I'm on my way there right now, driving, but and it's very much wild, 250 acres, and what I notice is that most people's relationship with nature is adversarial. I deal with this with my neighbors who will cut down a tree at the drop of a hat, and they're shooting guns and shooting at bears and all the things that I moved to the country for and to live in nature for, I constantly feel are under attack because people come into nature and feel like they have to subdue it or they have to change it. And it's just something that I feel that it just underlines the importance of saving places that are wild and natural.
Yeah, well said. I mean, it does underline the importance of preserving and valuing and protecting. And yet there are those, Steve Dunsky, who say there isn't any real wilderness anymore. I mean, in terms of what it was originally intended to be and saved.
Sure. Well, you know, 1989, Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature, and you know, he made the case that we don't have anything such as wild nature. Nothing. All parts of the planet have been impacted by human beings. And, you know, there is a case to be made for that. But we also know that we don't have complete control over nature either. Witness the recent earthquake that we had in Vallejo. So I think that there is an argument to be made also that there is plenty of
wildness.
That's
not what you're celebrating in
Vallejo. No, we're not celebrating. We're overcoming it and demonstrating our resilience as nature always does.
Let me bring another caller on from South Carolina. Bob, you're on. Hi.
Yes, thank you. I think it would be, you know, what I'd like to understand is that now that we have 9 million acres set aside in wilderness, that is for the romping around, tromping around, and enjoyment of affluent white people. Why do I still see on the agenda and people trying to suggest that maybe we need to add yet another forest, another few hundred thousand acres to a bank of wilderness reserve that is way more than what should have ever been proposed?
Well, it's more than 9 million acres now. It's closer to 110 million acres, but your question's still relevant. Why add to that? And you say what, Steve Dunsky?
Well, I say the reasons are still the same as when Aldo Leopold and his colleagues in the 1920s were doing it. They were looking at a situation where the country was being developed at a very rapid pace. The automobile was a huge part of that, and that was fragmenting the landscape. I know you've had Marianne Hannibal on this show, and she's talked about the importance of large expanses of land to preserve biodiversity. We know we're losing species at a very rapid rate, and wildernesses are these large expanses of land that provide habitat for animals. So if we're going to deal with climate change, if we're going to deal with water shortages, if we're going to deal with biodiversity loss, we need more wilderness, not less.
Would you add anything, Professor Unger?
Well, I would just say that, you know, all told, we're talking about 5% of the United States, and about half of that is in Alaska, that is actual wilderness land. So that's 2.7% of the contiguous United States is preserved as wilderness. So I don't think that's too much. I think I agree with Steve. We could add a whole lot more.
And we'll add another caller, and that's Frank from Mill Valley. Frank, you're on.
Hi, Michael. Just wanted to comment that the conservation movement seems to be the outgrowth of a perception that finally, we've reached the tipping point, and we're losing wilderness. So back in the day, some of the quotes that you were reading were when people still believed there was an infinite supply of wilderness to deal with. I'd like to ask the Forest Service gentleman, is there a split in the Forest Service between active management, the way you were talking about, and just don't touch it, let whatever happens, fires, et cetera, happen?
The Forest Service is a very diverse organization, and there are people that have different opinions. Sometimes people look at government agencies as being monolithic. We have a very strong research branch.
You do have that split, pretty much, you can characterize it that way.
I think that there are different viewpoints. I think our management is based in science, and we have a whole organization in Montana, the Aldo Leopold Research Institute, that actually studies wilderness areas and provides information to managers about how to best manage wilderness.
Science doesn't compel one point of view, though.
No, and of course, politics enters into this
as well.
As we
see in climate change and
so
many other things.
That's right.
Let me thank you for that call, Frank, and read an online comment from a listener named Sam, who says, I appreciate the importance of wilderness areas and Leopold's land ethic, but we must recognize that a lot of wilderness areas used to be the homelands of Native Americans. The Forest Service is holding countless acres of land that used to be tribal territory. I think a more responsible view of wilderness views the right of people to live within the area so long as they have a certain ethical relationship to their ecosystem. See?
Yeah, I don't know that the Forest Service is going to be able to undo all the harm that was done to the indigenous people of this country. We all know that there was a genocide. We all know that the West was not an unpopulated land that Europeans came into. The Forest Service, tries to work with tribes. We recognize the tribal sovereignty of those tribes. and we have a good relationship with them. However, we're not going to undo the damage that was done in the past.
Bring another caller. Jeremiah, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the intersection between wilderness and our human world. I hike a lot in a place called Wildcat Canyon. It's a regional park. And there's cattle grazing, and it's a sort of reclaimed ranch land. And I see wild turkeys and coyotes and all this sort of wilderness moving back in. And then also in the city, I like to go and watch hawks and, you know, we plant local plants and things like that. I wonder if your guests could talk about that sort of reclaiming of our human spaces.
Yeah, especially in urban areas. Nancy Unger?
Well, I think that that's really important that we don't just say, okay, we have wilderness, so that's taken care of, and now we can just pave the rest of everything else. I mean, this is one of the concerns about sort of prizing wilderness above everything else. If there's a tree in wilderness, is that any less, a miracle than a tree that's in a national park or a tree that's in your own backyard?
Or maybe too much emphasis on non-human habitats. Huh?
Yeah, well, or just that, nature doesn't just happen in wilderness. It's all around, even the suburbs, even in the cities, and that we need to be valuing that where it is, not only if it's out in the wilderness.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Nancy Unger, who is professor of history at Santa Clara University, and also to Steve Dunsky, who's a filmmaker with the U.S. Forest Service and organizer of the Vallejo Festival that's celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. And you're listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and that's Sharon on a cell phone. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment both to you, Michael, and to your speakers, that maybe you could do a show and let people know about a plan for a mine in Alaska that is on Native American property, Pebble Mine, and I cannot find anyone that I ever speak to that knows about this mine, and it's going to be one of the largest gold and copper mines in the world, and with a holding pond, with a dam, the biggest dam in the world, in a very sensitive area that is unbelievable, and it just there's nothing out there for people to really understand what they're planning up there.
No, I'm glad you brought it to our attention. Steve, you're familiar with Steve Dunsky?
I'm a little familiar with that. I've been to Alaska quite a bit, and I know that's a beautiful area. I want to point out that I think that the wilderness areas that we have in this country are largely due to citizen activists and people around the country who have worked very hard to protect the places where they live. And so I think it's very important that when an issue like this comes up that people become involved, because it's those voices that are going to protect an area where, for example, they want to build this pebble mine.
And let me thank you, Sharon, again for bringing that to our attention. Let me go to another caller, and that's you. Debbie, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. I just came out of backpacking 4 days in the Ansel Adams Wilderness, the Ritter Range north near Devil's Postpile. I want to comment. I saw 12 dogs, one chipmunk, and two birds.
Wow.
And the barking dogs were particularly jolting. So I think we need to... That needs to be reevaluated.
Keep the wilderness not only human-free, but canine-free.
That's all my comment. Thank
you. All right. Thank you for the comment. Good to hear from you. And let's hear from Aaron in San Rafael. Aaron, you're on.
Hi. Great program. A couple things. You know, science is entered into the conversation here, but I haven't heard anyone talk about carrying capacity yet and actually how many people there are. And it's wilderness is just here for our enjoyment, really, because we've only been here a short time, and people will be gone pretty soon, and things will sort of go to another static situation, and wilderness is always going to be here. It's just how we interact with it and decide to use it while we're here for this brief time.
Well, you're also raising the question of population. I mean, we do have a carrying capacity on this planet, and some would say we've exceeded it, but how much wilderness can we afford to have when we have all the population continuing to proliferate and expand? Steve Dunsky?
Well, so, for example, we have wilderness areas very close to the Bay Area, the Philip Burton Wilderness up at Point Reyes. The Forest Service manages the Desolation Wilderness up near Lake Tahoe. And one of our biggest challenges is how do we manage the use of that wilderness. I mean, a lot of it, we want people to have that experience of solitude and not hear the dogs barking. And so a lot of the challenge for the Forest Service and the Park Service is to actually figure out how many people do you allow in the wilderness areas, and what do you allow them to do, and how do you prevent them from doing harm? You know, wilderness is there for us to enjoy, but I think that's the importance of management.
Well, thank you for the call. That's from Aaron. And here's David, who writes, I resent your statement that wilderness has been preserved for the benefit of affluent, privileged white people. Is that what I said? No, I don't believe it's what I said. I said that I read something in High Country News to that effect. I can quote somebody and still somehow get blamed for it. Okay. Throughout my life, me, my children, and now my grandchildren have extensively used wilderness throughout the West. None of us are affluent, and we could not possibly have afforded such a close relationship with our lands if these areas were not available. Okay. Stacy writes, as part of the Wilderness Act 50th celebration, we're releasing an official podcast series called Untrammeled. The series will profile up to 44 different protected areas in the United States, including the challenges each area faces. Also upcoming are episodes about Death Valley and the Okefenokee Swamp, wildly different places that are still very wild. Wilderness50th.org/untrammeled. And Chris writes online, adaptation is critical at this point in human history. Our industrial development and monoculture farming limit our ability to adapt to change by breaking down ecosystems and attempting to subjugate nature in the wilderness. Human beings are an inextricable part of nature that cannot survive outside of it. And let's go to Somik. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I, by background, a decision analyst, and I had the opportunity to study environmental conservation movements. And I found a very surprising fact, that is, a lot of governments across the world, every time they try to conserve a forest, what they would do is they would kick the indigenous people out, and those forests would get decimated very quickly. But the only forests, there was one forest in Nepal where they managed to conserve it very well. That was a forest where the indigenous people were given the responsibility to protect their own home.
There's an important point, and it's one we're going to have to end with. Somik, thank you for that, and thank you, Steve Dunsky, and thank you, Nancy Unger, and thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and we get online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.